This is now talk 9 in the series on how to identify and handle wicked people. So let's look a little more closely at some of the way that procedures and safeguards are used in criminal trials, but how they don't apply to you, and you mustn't impose them on yourself. You have no duty to do so. So in your dealings with wrongdoers at work or church or wherever. So as we've seen, a criminal trial sets the burden of proof at an extremely high level, beyond all reasonable doubt. Civil trial, balance of probabilities. You should not operate like a criminal trial. You don't have to be convinced to that level. And I stress that because many wrongly think that they do have to be. And that the evidence needs to be utterly overwhelming before they can believe that something is the case. It just doesn't. And you need to really grasp that, because consider the implication if you were to believe that. Let's imagine that A comes to you to make a complaint about B in the church or in work or wherever. And you hold that view, that you must be convinced beyond all reasonable doubt before you'll believe A. Now, if that's the case, can you see that if you're not prepared to believe something against B, unless it's proved beyond all reasonable doubt, you're effectively refusing to believe A. You're rejecting A. You're not, because you think, I don't want to believe this about B in case I do an injustice to B. Therefore, I must be convinced beyond all reasonable doubt. Well, can you see that if you hold that view, you're doing an injustice to A? A has been bullied at work. A has been harmed in the church. Something's been done. But you will not believe A or give justice to A or help A or support A because you haven't been convinced beyond all reasonable doubt that B did it. Do you see? So of course you're not doing an injustice to B, but you are doing an injustice to A. And that's why it's an inappropriate burden of proof. It's going to cause you to inevitably make lots and lots of wrong decisions where you refuse to give help where you should. You refuse to protect the innocent. You refuse to protect the weak because their case against the strong hasn't been totally proved. And once you see it in that way, the absurdity of it becomes obvious. So moreover, unlike in a criminal court, you can allow yourself to be influenced by checking up on a person's past behaviour and reputation. Of course, jurors aren't allowed to know anything. If they know the defendant, they can't be on the jury. And even to the point of if they have any kind of reason to have any kind of opinion about anything to do with the case, they can't be on the jury. You know, if they've got any kind of basis for knowing anything about it or holding any view, they're ineligible. And I've heard even in an employment law context, you see, employment law operates on the basis of the test that I spoke of, the balance of probabilities. And you don't have in employment law this prohibition either about not knowing about past behaviour and conduct. That's not there. But I've heard many managers in appeals hearings at tribunals and in cases I've dealt with speaking in this way, managers in businesses who are perhaps dealing with an internal appeal. You know how you get it. This manager sacks you. This manager deals with the appeal. This manager deals with the final appeal, all that kind of thing. I've heard managers at tribunals speaking as if they needed to shield themselves from the facts of the case about the employee's past record in case it might influence my view. Now, can you see how silly that is? You're trying to come to a view about the man's trustworthiness, credibility, whether he did it, what kind of person he is. Why would you want to shield yourself from knowledge about his background when making the decision about what he did on this occasion? You might say, it's because I have a high sense of justice. Well, you might, perhaps, in relation to the accused or to the applicant in the employment case, you might have a sense of justice towards him. But you haven't got a sense of justice towards the victim of him. It cuts both ways. So if you're going to put blinkers on yourself, you're not allowing yourself to know things, you're going to make it almost inevitable that you'll make wrong decisions, false findings of innocence, because you don't tell yourself the whole facts. So when you're dealing with something, you're not in a crown court. You're allowed to find out everything you can properly find out, everything. It's all available to you. It's entirely right and proper for you to have as much information as you can reasonably find about their reputation, background, past history, past complaints, past allegations. And you mustn't think that you're under a duty to refrain from looking at such things. Neither do you have to compartmentalise your mind, as judges have to do, whereby they refuse to let themselves take a particular piece of evidence into account. Sometimes judges do that. They say, I'm going to make my decision, but I will not take into account fact number five or something. I will not take that into account in making the decision. Now, sometimes judges do that, but you don't have to do that. You're free to find out what you can. You're also free to speak to others about the person's past behaviour or about similar or different complaints that have been made about him previously by others. There's nothing wrong with that, and you need to weigh them up carefully. And so you also should feel entitled to ask questions, because you'd be amazed at how much other people do know, but which they've never mentioned for one reason or another. An exception to that might be where what you're dealing with is highly confidential, such that you cannot properly reveal that you're doing an investigation. Another reason would be where you don't yet feel able to trust the other people in order to ask them, because they themselves might be suspects, or you're not able to trust them with the information. So if so, you might say, well, I won't trust them by telling them what I'm doing or why I'm doing it, or even that I'm doing an investigation, but I will nonetheless seek information in a more covert manner without revealing my purpose. I'm just going to find out information. So when you are dealing with an inquiry, you're entitled to look into things properly. You don't have to deny yourself knowledge and deny yourself understanding of things. You can also feel free to speak to other people who are trusted and get their advice and help to help you to understand it correctly, to help you to get a sense of proportion. I think that helps a lot. Someone who's outside the situation. Let's imagine you've been the victim of abuse in a church. When a person is abused in a church, I don't mean insulted, I don't mean that kind of abuse. I mean treated abusively, taken advantage of, used. It's very, very, very common. The victim who is subject to that campaign of abuse, bullying, etc., frequently loses their sense of proportion and their ability to assess the significance of what's happening or the rightness and wrongness of the way they're being treated. But if they speak to someone outside the situation, the facts then appear much clearer to the person sometimes outside the situation than to they who are within it. And they can form a better understanding of it and get a better sense of proportion about it. Now, here's another thing you do not need to do when you're dealing with a problem, an inquiry, an allegation in your own capacity, because you must understand that it's not only high and mighty people that have to deal with these things. Lots of ordinary folk have to deal with things that where they have to decide whether someone's innocent, whether someone's guilty, in all sorts of contexts. Even in the very smallest church, this may become necessary. So another misconception is to think that you've got to presume that people are all innocent until proven guilty. Now, that's quite rightly how criminal trials operate. That's how they do it, because so much is at stake for the defendant. He could lose his reputation, his job, his liberty, if the jury or the magistrates find him guilty. Therefore, it's a huge decision, and the legal system seeks to stack the odds in favour of the accused. That's what it does. But you're not a court, and you don't have to do that, and you shouldn't do that. You don't need to impose any such restraint upon yourself. So when you're inquiring into a matter about whether a man is guilty or innocent of something, do not assume that people are innocent until they are proved guilty. Don't assume anything. Conduct yourself throughout the inquiry on the basis that they could be innocent and they could be guilty. They could be either. Don't make the assumption that they aren't guilty while you're trying to work out whether they're guilty. And you see, if you're going around making assumptions about the conclusion of the very case that you're dealing with, these unspoken conclusions that you're sort of forming and imposing upon yourself while you investigate the case are going to inevitably colour the way in which you look at the evidence. Because here you are, presuming him to be innocent, while you're looking at whether he's innocent. You know, it's simply inappropriate for an individual like you to look at a situation in that way. The right and proper thing to do whilst inquiring into something is to hold no opinions at all and just look at the whole thing and see where the evidence brings you. So don't start imposing these sort of fanciful burdens upon yourself. But also, this is important as well, even after you finish your inquiries. So let's imagine you finish your inquiries, but you don't have a clear outcome. You don't really have enough to form an opinion. There's just not enough information to come to a view that you feel happy with. You know, there's just too many missing pieces from the jigsaw to come to a view. Right? Well, again, in that situation, you know what happens in the films? You get this trial judge who says to the chap, you know, this is what happens on Poirot and things like that. And the trial judge says, you know, you leave this court with your character intact and your reputation unstained. Well, you see, that might be appropriate to say that in some criminal court. I think it happens more on the telly than it does in reality. But the point is, that might be okay to say in a criminal court. It's not okay for you to say that. So if a person has been the subject of an inquiry by you, but you just haven't been able to get properly to the bottom of it all, there's too many contradictions, too many missing pieces, you don't need to declare him to be innocent and treat him as such and come to the decision that he's absolutely innocent and has his reputation unstained. What you would do is you would simply do as they do in Scotland and have a verdict unproven. So he's not innocent, or not guilty rather, he's unproven. That means you're not saying he's guilty, but you aren't saying he's not guilty. You're saying, we don't know about this one. So therefore, if you say that, what does that mean? It means that you'll be willing to try him again for the same offence. Now, in England, until recently, there was a reform of the situation, but for a long, long time, if you were found not guilty, you couldn't be tried again for the same case. Even if you wrote to the Times and said, I'm guilty of it. Even if you released evidence proving your own guilt, video evidence of you committing the murder, you couldn't be tried again for it because you've been tried. And that was the absurdity of our system. It was to guard against what's called double jeopardy. Now, that's been tempered. For big cases now, they will actually try you again after you've been found not guilty in England. In Scotland, they never had all that. So if someone was found unproven, then later evidence emerges that makes the whole position a lot clearer, they would try the same man again. Now, you can do it that way. So where something isn't clear, you can, in your own mind, consider it unproven. But from this point on, I'm going to keep a close eye on him. And if anything arises again, I'll be certainly willing to try him again for the same offence. And also, when and if anything ever happens again, I shall be much quicker to take it seriously and act upon it than I was last time. Because instead of him going from this court with his character intact and his reputation unstained, you were saying he's going forth from my court with a big question mark over his head about what I think. And I'm going to be willing to look much more closely at things in future, much quicker as well, and less quick to give the benefit of the doubt than I was this time. More willing to believe complainants than I was this time. So another point, when you're facing several issues or concerns about a person's character, conduct, attitude, if it's a person you're concerned about, I would recommend this: write all the points down in one document. This relates to the point I was saying previously about dealing with all the issues at once. It's a similar point, but slightly different. What I'm saying here is write it all down in a document. And the reason I say that is that if you look at all the allegations, all the complaints, all the incidents, all the niggles, all the little doubts, all the little concerns, put them all down in a document, you make it much easier for yourself to see the pattern. You also make it much easier for yourself to see the scale, the significance, the seriousness of what's happening here. But if you don't, then what happens is this. If you try to look at each thing one by one, what you find is that you can't think simultaneously about lots of things. So while you're thinking about this, you're not thinking about that. And you can't kind of hold all the things in your mind simultaneously. So you're trying to decide whether he did this. And while you're thinking about that, you're only thinking about that. And then over here, you're trying to decide whether he did this. And while you're thinking about that, everything else seems to go out of your mind. You just think about that. But if you write everything down in one list, it enables you to see how the things link together. And you see the pattern. You also see the scale. And that's important because when you start doing this technique, you'll be quite surprised sometimes how long your list is. Because what you'll frequently find is you've got these sort of bubbling concerns inside you, just niggling things that you've never really put entirely into words, but you've just got this uneasiness about so-and-so. This uneasiness about their behaviour in the church and their behaviour in the workplace or whatever. But when you write down everything you're concerned about, everything that your colleagues are concerned about, everything that you've been told and alleged by others, write it all down. And sometimes what's staring back at you off the page, and sometimes it's not a page, sometimes it's 10 pages, what's staring back at you from these 10 pages suddenly looks like a very compelling case. And previously you've been thinking, I'm so confused, I just don't know what to think. But then you look at the whole document in one go, sometimes you'll think, why on earth was I confused? This is a compelling and very serious situation here. But you'd never really seen it because you'd never tried to list them. You'd never tried to get it all in one place. Everything was previously just floating around simultaneously, like lots of flies buzzing around in a room, instead of having all of it in one document. Another useful technique I've used, similar to this, is where I'm dealing with someone, whether it be an employee, whether it be a person in a church. Like with Rick, I used to write long letters to Rick setting out the situation. It's amazing how it clears your own thoughts when you put it all down into one document. But also, and this is important, when you write such a letter to the opponent, and I used to do this when I was practicing law as well, if I was representing my client, I would write letters. I would use letters within litigation. A lot of people don't like to use letters much. They call it litigating by correspondence, and they don't like it. I liked it because I found my letters were very effective. And what I would do is write out what I think my position is, what my client's case is. And very, very often, I'd get no reply. Nobody could answer the letters. And the reason is because the situation, when put into a document like that, is frequently very, very compelling. And, so therefore, I would write all these things, and it would be very, very hard for the opponent to answer it. Even harder if he's an unrepresented person in your church or workplace. But even for a represented person, his solicitor doesn't know how to answer it. And usually that's because his case is weak and yours is strong. So writing it down in that way frequently reveals his inability to answer it. And you're entitled to take into account his complete inability to answer it. That's a very important fact that should have a major bearing on the way you look at the whole thing. So why can't this person answer it? They don't have to answer it eloquently. I'm not asking for that. Just to answer it at all. Just to explain why, they slipped on the pavement and punched 9 people in a row. Why did they do that? Explain it, please. You're asking for an explanation of each of the things. What happened here? Why did that happen? Why did that happen? And what you'll find, when you put it all into one place, you see, the person relies upon just denying, just stout denial. Like Rumpole of the Bailey. His motto was, he denies everything. So they just deny everything you say. And it can be confusing and bewildering to you. But when they have it all in a document and they just deny, 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 somehow the position becomes a lot clearer to you. And the thing is as well, it becomes a lot clearer to them. They realise they're done for. And so frequently, my letters used to get no reply when I was writing, practicing law. And if someone was to make a film, hopefully not with Mr. Bean playing me, but if they made a film of my back, correspondence, based on my correspondence, it would look like I was just writing to an imaginary friend a lot of the time, because there'd be just my letters going out and no answer coming back. And what we very often used to get in response to one of my letters was just a check in payment or a settlement offer or a check in full payment or whatever. No reply, just a check. Now, doesn't that sound to you like an admission of guilt? Do you see? And so the thing is, but it's obvious once you think about it, but most people don't write their whole case down. Most people don't write anything. They just have lots of thoughts buzzing around like flies in a room on a hot day. And at any given moment, they can look at one fly and follow him around the room. And that's that thought. But then they take their eyes off that fly, look at another fly, follow him around the room. But at any given moment, they're not thinking about all the issues. But this document or letter helps you to do it. Another advantage of doing this, I mean, you don't picture the scene as being some huge case, you know, involving millions of pounds. This is just some argument in the church or the workplace involving little folk, that as little as you are, just in the church or wherever. The other thing is this, where it's helpful, is you're sitting in a meeting. Let's imagine you might not even send the letter. You might not even send the document to the person. Sometimes it's appropriate to send it and see what reply you get. Sometimes you might think, I'm not going to send it, I'm just going to use it as an aid memoir to take me through the evidence. So I'm going to say to this person, now here I am going to interview them, but I've got my written document with 14 points on it, all of which are suspicious. And I'm going to take them through it item by item. Now when you do that, what you'll find is it gives you much more confidence to deal with the case. I use the word case, but it's in a church, you know, it's very informal. Much more confidence to deal with a dispute, shall we say, but also gives you far greater clarity of thought, because you can see all these things in a line on a page and deal with them one by one. Instead of having the other person just making everything nebulous, because what they want is to keep everything really vague, undefined, unspecified, unclear. And then it's easy to deny lots of nebulous, gaseous, sort of unspoken, unspecified allegations that are buzzing about. But to deny 14 different things that are all written down on a document is harder. And what you'll frequently find as well, when you do this, not only will the person fail to reply or be unable to reply, but they may frequently realise they're defeated, and that's when you'll gain an extra piece of evidence, because until this point, they've been keeping a mask on, keeping up an appearance. But when they see that you're going to win and they're going to lose, very often the person will take the mask off. And when you have this meeting and go through the stuff, very politely, all the meetings I've ever conducted in my life have been the most polite meetings you could ever imagine. There's no shouting and yawping going on. It's just very politely. It's devastating how powerful it is when you're just very quiet and polite. And then you'll see the way the person's demeanour will alter. When they see you've nailed them, frequently their demeanour alters and they become very hostile, very sort of insulting even, and abusive even. And you'll see a side of them you'd never seen before. Now why have you seen it? You might say, well, you're seeing it because they're upset that you've written these 14 things about them. That's not what's doing it. If the 14 things were wrong, they would answer them properly, wouldn't they? They're angry because you've written 14 things that are true and you've nailed them. That's what's making them angry. Not the fact that you've made 14 false accusations. Because if you'd made 14 false accusations, they would rebut them strenuously, wouldn't they? And they wouldn't have any difficulty finding the words to do it. Even if they're not eloquent people, they'd find the words to say, that's a load of rubbish, I'll tell you what happened there. But if they know you've nailed them, not only will you have that silence, but you'll also have sometimes hostility. And that's good, because that's helping you to weigh up the situation. Because remember, what's the objective here? You're trying to figure out whether A or B is telling the truth, whether A is wicked or B is wicked or what. You need every piece of help you can get. And if they do become, take their mask off and become openly hostile in response to your perfectly polite exposition of your case and your evidence in support of it, I think that's something you're perfectly entitled to take into account in deciding whether you trust the person. But you see, you probably would never have got that intemperate response from them or that extra evidence if you hadn't written your detailed list or letter, which most people never do. And most people go into a meeting to talk about what happened, and it's all purely verbal. And by the end of the meeting, no record is kept, nothing's written down. At the end of the meeting, nobody can quite remember what was said. No one can quite remember what was alleged or why or how. And at the end of it, it's all so nebulous and utterly vaporous that nobody has the confidence to form a view on it. And the accused person, not just in a criminal context, but in any context, that suits him down to the ground. He wants everything very, very vague, not crisp, clear, and set out very, very fully. Okay, another point. Never form a positive judgment about a person based solely on what they say. Always judge others primarily by what they do, by their actions and by what their lives produce. Now, you can validly form a negative view of a person based solely on what they say. So if they say something which is unbiblical, which is sinful, which is wrong, which is wicked, if they say a negative thing, you can say, that was a negative thing and I'm going to have regard to that, and that has caused me now to relegate this person from not trusted to distrusted. You know, I previously held no view, now I hold an adverse view based solely on what they've said. And I now distrust them, see? But so you could do that based solely on what a person says, but you can't form a positive view based solely on what a person says. You couldn't move from not trusting, i.e. blank sheet of paper, no basis to trust the person yet. You can't move from there to trust based solely on something they say to you. You would need to see fruit over a reasonably sustained period of time. But you don't need a reasonably sustained period of time to move to distrust, and even if that is based solely on what the person says. So now let me move to another point, which is this, because I want to add an important counterbalancing point to some of the things I've been saying, because this needs to be borne in mind, especially if you have been persuaded by what I'm saying here or elsewhere. You've now been persuaded that the wicked are numerous and they need to be taken seriously. So let's imagine previously you hadn't realised that they were numerous and you hadn't realised they need to be taken seriously. Now you've been persuaded of that. Now let's put in place an important counterbalancing warning or caveat that you need to bear in mind. Because frequently when people move from a place of simplicity and naivety and sincerity and guilelessness, and they just don't have much of a clue, no discernment, they move from there over to a place where, you know, they now have reason to suspect things and to suspect people. Frequently people go too far in that direction and end up becoming paranoid, seeing wickedness and conspiracies everywhere, becoming distrustful of everyone. Remember, the word distrustful is not the same as not trusting people. Not trusting is completely neutral. Distrustful means you now hold a negative view. There's a blot on the page. So you then can end up becoming distrustful of everyone, or most people, even of those who have consistently demonstrated by their fruits that they are trustworthy. So you can end up just not trusting or distrusting everybody. Now, most Christians, I think, are clustered at the South Pole in that they're naive, overly trusting of everybody they meet, unable to discern anything. But sometimes, if they become emotionally scarred by bad experiences at the hands of the wicked, they change and go the other direction. But sometimes they go too far. They go to the North Pole, where they are then made dysfunctional through paranoia. And they are distrustful of everybody, like a wounded animal, like a wild animal that, you know, you approach it to help it, but it distrusts you. It thinks you're a human and it wants to run away from you. And a Christian can become like that, where everybody is a threat, everybody's a danger, everybody's wicked, everybody's a villain. Now that, some people would look upon that and consider that to be evidence of discernment, that they have become discerning, because now they think everybody's wicked. They think everybody's a crook, everybody's horrible, everybody's going to get me, everybody's involved in a conspiracy against me. Now that's not discernment, that's just being silly. That's just being wrong. So thinking that everybody is wicked is just as inaccurate as thinking that nobody's wicked. That's not the case. It manifestly is not the case that everybody is in this category called the wicked. Otherwise, the Bible wouldn't speak about the other categories: the wicked, the fool, the simple, and the wise. There are manifestly other people in those other groups. Now, we can argue about the relative numbers within each group. You can hold your own opinions, but what we cannot say is that everybody's wicked. But we mustn't do that. Now, bear in mind the devil's overall strategy, which is implemented for him by the demons. He doesn't go around, by the way, the devil doesn't, probably never heard of any of us in this room, doesn't know any of us, but the demons do. His strategy is implemented for him by them. He sets the strategy. They implement it at a local level. Now bear in mind, what is his strategy? His preference, at least in the West, is for you not to know about them, of course, but in terms of people, what does he want? His preference is for you to be naive, unaware, undiscerning, easily deceived, easily manipulated. That's the ideal scenario from their perspective. But if they see that you're beginning to change from that, you're beginning to wake up, your eyes are opening, you're beginning to get a measure of discernment, what would you do if you were a demon in that situation? I know what I'd do if I was a demon in that situation. I would seek instead to get you to the other direction. I'd seek to say, well, here he's been nicely at the South Pole, which is where we want him. But look, he's heading northward. He's heading towards beginning to understand discernment. We need to wreck this. We need to move in now and do something about this. The best thing to do now is to take this person and seriously over-egg it and become wildly too prejudiced, jaundiced, negative, cynical, suspicious of everything and everyone. Let's take him to as far to the North Pole as we possibly can. And so, imagine these two alternative situations. Imagine a doctor, a general practitioner. Now, he's currently unaware of, unwilling to believe that anybody's got cancer or anybody will ever get cancer. He doesn't believe in it. He never diagnoses anybody with cancer. He doesn't think, whatever people present with, he never sees cancer as an outcome. He never sees that. He doesn't recognize that. He's always diagnosing it as something else. And he doesn't diagnose cancer. He doesn't even send people for tests for cancer, because he doesn't believe that they've got cancer. Or he might think it's incredibly rare. And in my medical career, over 40 years, I might meet maybe 2 cancer patients. So the people I'm meeting today, I'm going to assume they definitely don't have any cancer. And wouldn't that be totally misguided? But what if he was to go to the other extreme and he instead was to assume everybody's got cancer? He's obsessed with cancer. He sees cancer everywhere. Everybody that comes in with the slightest symptom of anything at all, his first thought is cancer. It's probably cancer. And so he's immediately jumping to diagnosis and then treatment. And the treatment will be radical. Radical intervention, chemotherapy, radiation, even surgery. Wouldn't he be a menace? Or which was best? The one who doesn't believe there's any cancer, or the one that believes everybody's got cancer? And in this context, you can see plainly, you don't want to be treated by either of these doctors, do you? Well, what do you want? You want someone who's willing to believe there is such a thing as cancer, and also quite aware of the fact that it's very prevalent. But, at the same time, aware that most people don't have cancer, at any rate not at the moment, and he's only wanting to diagnose it where it's there and only wanting to treat it where it's real, and he doesn't want to either diagnose it or treat it when it's not there. So you don't want either of those, do you? You want to head to the equator, whether you're a doctor or a Christian trying to deal with wickedness. You want to head to the equator, whereby you're genuinely discerning, you're seeing wickedness where it really is, you're not imagining where it isn't, imagining it where it isn't. It's a place of balance, in which you assess and classify every situation or person with an open mind, based on the evidence and on shrewd, wise discernment. So simply assuming as a blanket assumption that everybody's wicked is not discernment. That's error. And it's just as naive to think that as it is to think the opposite, that nobody's wicked. Now, the most common problem, of course, and the main one that this book is seeking to remedy, is the tendency to be naive and to assume that nobody's wicked or hardly anybody's wicked. You know, Joseph Stalin is wicked, but apart from him, virtually nobody. You see, that's the main problem we're seeking to remedy. But it's so easy to fall into the opposite trap and become cynical and jaundiced and suspicious and prejudiced, even paranoid. And if you do that, it suits the demons right down to the ground, because you will become incapable of forming and maintaining relationships with people, because you're just so suspicious all the time. Do you see? Now, that being suspicious all the time of everybody you meet is not discerning, any more than it would be for a GP to think everybody in the waiting room out there has got cancer. Every single one of them. I'll tell you what, I'll tell you, nurse, you watch me now. Every one of them, the lot of them, every last one, all cancer. And what would you think of such a GP? Do you see? The nurse would say, this doctor's gone a bit crazy. He's gone on this course on cancer, and since he came back, he's obsessed with cancer. He thinks cancer's everywhere. Do you see? That's not discerning. That's not accurate diagnosis. It's error. It's naivety. So, the thing is, from the demon's perspective, this analogy springs to mind. Have ever any of you done judo? I did judo for a while. And one of the principles of judo is you want to get your opponent to overbalance, to lose his balance. And so you can, by means of that, you can use your opponent's bigger height and bigger weight against him. Because if he loses his balance, you can make him fall really well. And the bigger he is, the harder he'll fall. And what you'll do, what will you do in judo? If you see that your opponent is leaning too far to the left, you'll want to push him further to the left. If your opponent is leaning to the right, you'll want to push him further to the right. If he's leaning backwards, you want to push him back. If he's leaning forward, you'll want to pull him forwards. And you could even put your foot in his stomach, fall backwards yourself, and throw him over your head. Because he's leaning forward, and you think, I'll have him, and off he goes over your head. Whichever way he leans, you're wanting to use his lack of balance against him, and to accentuate the lack of balance, accentuate the imbalance, and to take it from a mild imbalance to a severe imbalance. And that is what the demons want to do with you. So if you're naive, they want you more naive. If you're beginning to be discerning, they want you to say, let's not be discerning. Let's get this man to be completely cynical. You know, he's so suspicious of everybody. You know, he sees wickedness everywhere. He's a complete conspiracy theorist. And not just on a macro scale, but in a micro scale. Everybody in the church is a villain. Everybody around him is a thief and a crook. Everybody around him can't be trusted. Do you see? That's not good, and they're perfectly happy for you to go that way as a second choice. They'd rather you were completely naive. If they can't have that, second choice is way over the top suspicious. What don't they want? What's the thing they really fear you becoming? Balanced, knowledgeable. Knowledgeable about the Bible. Knowledgeable about human nature. Aware of how to gauge and identify things. Aware of the prevalence of wickedness, but aware also that it's not absolutely ubiquitous everywhere. You're aware that it's widespread, but you know that it's not in everyone. Do you see? And you're open-minded to find it, but neither are you assuming it. You're open-minded to say, I'm willing to hear the evidence in any direction and go wherever it takes me. I won't form a conclusion until I've looked at as many tests as I've got available to me, and then I'll form a balanced conclusion based on the whole evidence available. Whichever way it goes, I'll form a conclusion. I'm open-minded. That is what the demons fear. That is what they don't want you to be. And so, another point. When you're diagnosing wickedness, as when diagnosing an illness, you generally need to be looking for a number of factors and signs rather than forming a judgment based solely on one fact or event. I've mentioned this already, but let me mention it again. The thing is, each of the tests I'm advocating are valid tests, need to be looked at on their own. They have to be looked at on their own. Everything that you do has to be done on its own while you're doing it, but then you go on to do other things as well. So you'll want, ideally, to be looking for as many factors, as many tests, as many pieces of evidence as you can find. That doesn't mean that you need to know everything, because you'll never know everything. You'll never have total knowledge, complete, absolute, comprehensive evidence of everything. That'll never happen to you. But what you can have is a sufficient package of evidence whereby each piece of evidence is sufficiently corroborative of the other pieces of evidence to make a mistake, most unlikely. So that if you've got 5 or 6 pieces of evidence corroborating each other, the chances of you misconstruing each one of those things on its own is much smaller, because you've got to get them all wrong, and they've all got to be, you know, you've got them all currently consistent, and it would have to be a strange sort of set of events for all this evidence to be pointing this way. You see, so if you're looking at several tests, you're making it much harder for you to make a mistake, much harder for the demons to trip you up. So there, we've just spoken of the judo point. Here you are now, you've learned about 1 or 2 tests. You try this test. What will the demon do if he sees you doing a particular test? He'll get you to overreact to it and rely solely on that, not try any other tests. And that maximizes the chance of you getting it wrong and misjudging people. So, you know, what would you think if you were a doctor? You wouldn't leap to the conclusion that someone's got chickenpox just because you see red spots on them. It could, yes, they have got red spots, but you'd want to see other symptoms to convince you that it is chickenpox and not something else. Maybe it's an allergic reaction. Maybe it's another infectious disease, but not chickenpox. And you'd want to see the widest possible package of symptoms that you would put together and say, in conjunction, this package of symptoms points to chickenpox as opposed to another thing. And equally with us, we must do that. Take into account every piece of information and every piece of evidence that you can reasonably gather to maximize the chances of forming a correct judgment. But it doesn't need to be that you can never form a judgment ever, because you've always got to be searching for more, more, more. There is a reasonable amount of evidence that makes it reasonable for you to form a view. It doesn't have to be complete, absolutely comprehensive. But you'll also want to be checking and double checking in both directions. So you're looking out for, you want to find out whether the good reports and positive indicators are true and reliable. But you're also wanting to test whether the rumours and suspicions and accusations and allegations and negative indicators are true and reliable. In both directions, you're wanting to test and challenge the evidence that's in front of you rather than only in one direction. And if you do that, you make yourself much harder for demons to trick, because that's what they do. And just the other day, I was writing something on Facebook about demons. And some non-Christian people were on this particular line of discussion. Anyway, they wrote back to me talking about this. One of them said, are you real? You don't really believe in that, do you? And I said, yeah, I'm real. And then one of them wrote back about me being from some past century. You know, what century are you living in? The thing is, I believe in demons. I believe they're active and involved in our daily lives. I am, I mean, I spoke earlier of not hyping yourself up, but I can say this. I think I am the most ordinary, balanced, sensible, sane, rational person you're probably likely to meet for a good while. And yet, I'm saying to you, I believe demons are real. Amen. They're not something that just happened in the Bible, but now they've all gone and bought retirement homes in Spain, where they're all living peacefully, leaving us alone. They're all just as active as they were then. So the thing is, you've got to make yourself harder to trick. Checking things in both directions. Not leaping to conclusions, but equally not being intimidated or reluctant or unwilling to form a conclusion. There has to be a willingness, but not a hastiness. And with all of these tests, which I'm advocating, you need to realize that as when someone is studying medicine or law, it's when you're a first-year law student or even a third-year law student, you're not safe to be let loose with any client, because a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. And so, you know, you look back with, you wince with embarrassment at some of the essays you might write as a first or second or third year, because you were overly emphasizing one particular point or not taking into account lots of other points which have a bearing upon the issue. And what you do as you get more mature and experienced in the job, you're capable of applying several tests, applying several legal principles to the situation, not just getting hung up on one and going and writing your whole essay based on that, you see. And likewise with this, a little knowledge can be a dangerous thing. Applying one test over zealously or over hastily or in the absence of other tests will frequently lead you into wrong decisions. Okay. Another thing, another trick that the demons will use is getting you to take offense too easily and too quickly, causing you to take their bait with others. By taking offense at things you've heard or that you suspect others have said. So don't be too quick to believe what you are told about what others have said or what they've done to you. It's amazing how quick people are to believe anything that's said to them, especially if it's an insult or a criticism. You just believe it without investigation. So naivety doesn't only consist of being too slow to believe a report. It also consists of being too quick to believe a report. And many of us are far too ready to believe evil of others who may well be innocent, just because of something someone has said about them. You see, you've got to remember everything cuts both ways. So becoming discerning is not just the process of becoming willing to believe that some people are wicked. It's also becoming willing to believe that some people are being falsely accused. Do you see? Why don't we just believe everything that Donald Trump says about Ted Cruz? Answer, because Donald Trump is lying about Ted Cruz. We need to be capable not only of seeing the wickedness of Donald Trump, but capable of seeing the virtue of Ted Cruz. Both involve and require discernment. And it's equally the case in your own private life, the people you know. Because the demons will seek to make false accusations against the innocent just as much as they will seek to hide from your eyes the guilt of the guilty. Either way, both ways suit them. And in my own case, I've been amazed at times about how willing people have been to believe false statements made about me personally without a shred of investigation or any attempt to verify anything that's said. And those people have just believed what they were told without checking a thing. Not at all. Not a thing at all. And in that way, the demons, and also the wicked, not just the demons, find it easy to drive a wedge between good and decent people. They take advantage of your willingness to immediately believe and take offense at the things that you're told, which others have allegedly said or done. And if we could all be aware of that and check out the things that have allegedly been said or done, don't just believe it, check it out. Be aware that, remember how I spoke to you earlier, how unwilling most people are to come and tell you things. Well, if a person comes and tells you things, you need to say, These people are doing something which is, by, you know, normally quite a rare thing to do. They're coming and telling me something. Most people aren't willing to do that. What's motivating this person? Why are they coming and telling me this? I'm going to check out this accusation. I'm being accused, you know, this is being said. It's being said that person A has been horrible to me and done this and that to me. I'm not just going to believe that. I'm going to check it out, because it could be that person A has been horrible to me, but it could be that person B is lying to me to get me to fall out with person A, because B wants me and A to fall out. Now, you just have to have enough IQ to see that that is a perfectly possible explanation of what's happened. It's just as possible for it to be that as it is that person B is truly and genuinely reporting to you something about person A and what A has said. This is the whole point. Lies are going on all over the place, and you mustn't just assume that lies are only in a certain place. So if someone comes and reports to you something that another person has done against you, why would you assume that that must be true? That in itself could be untrue. And what you must do is guard against taking offence, because if you take offence, what taking offence will do is cause you to become an unfair trial judge, because you will be a prejudiced trial judge in this, in relation to this particular piece of investigation, because you're all riled up. So don't be riled up. What you need to do is look at it calmly, weigh it up, weigh up whether it was said, weigh up whether it was done, and don't take offence at it, but deal with it. And that will prevent you overreacting or acting prematurely, or take listening to and believing a lie being told to you, which, the purpose of which is to cause you to break a relationship with someone whom God wants you to be with. And how many times has that happened in churches, where the good people are split apart by the wicked, by false accusations being told? I mean, just countless times that is done. So that's not to say that that's always happening. The point is, nothing is always happening. The point is that it could be one of the things that's a possible explanation of what may be happening. So, let's go on now to look more closely at this subject of dealing with deception and deceivers. So we shall start this, and I'm moving more slowly through the material than I expected to do. So I'm going to have to carry on with this deception and deceivers thing in the next meeting. But let's make a start on it today. So first point, I think, to make is this. Recognize the possibility, or rather the likelihood, that people may be lying to you. And that's one of the very first steps to make in becoming discerning. Accepting the fact that some people act in really devious ways, and that you currently don't know who they are, but then you know they exist, and you know that you have a duty to try to find out who they are. Now, that is the basic starting point. So don't rule out the idea that people in general, or even any particular person, could ever be lying to you. People could be lying to you. That doesn't mean that they are, or that you think they are. You're just open to the possibility that they may be. Another point in relation to dealing with deception and deceivers is, don't assume that you're a good judge of character. As I said earlier, most of us are not a good judge of character. People boast about being a good judge of character, but most people are not. Only the wicked tend to be good judges of character on the whole. They're pretty shrewd at weighing things up. They know what to look for. Part of one of the advantages they have over us is they have no illusions to begin with. Nothing surprises them. So the wicked have that advantage, whereas many of us are under a whole series of illusions about people. But even admitting to yourself that you aren't currently a good judge of character is a really helpful starting point. For a start, it's an aspect of humbling yourself, as I mentioned, and you can't get enough of that. But also, admitting to yourself that you're not a good judge of character causes you to say, that being so, didn't I ought to start addressing this question of being more discerning and learning how to judge character better? Oughtn't I to be more diligent in looking at issues, facts, evidence, examining things, questioning things? And if you will do that, you can then begin the slow process of learning how to discern. But you can't even start learning how to discern until you acknowledge that you need to learn how to discern. And if you're already giving yourself a 10 out of 10 for discernment, well, why would you need to do any more? All you would say is, well, thankfully, I'm tremendously discerning, and so therefore all I need to do is carry on as I've been doing. My present performance is like Torval and Dean, absolutely perfect. No need for me to change or develop anything. Perfectly okay as I am. If you were to say that, explicitly or implicitly, you are not going to develop. So, another point. For various reasons, most of us, in fact perhaps all of us, find lies much more believable than the truth. That I've found to be almost a universal situation. People are just much, much readier, much quicker to believe a lie than they are to believe the truth. And I think for a number of reasons. One is our sinful nature simply finds lies more appealing. Lies are appealing to us. We like them because we're corrupt at our heart level. You see? The heart is deceitful of all things and desperately wicked. That's what you're like on the inside. And so if that's what your heart is like, that's what your flesh nature is like, then you're going to be drawn towards lies. You're going to have a preference for lies, not only telling them but believing them. And I think that's part of our sin nature. Another factor is the involvement of demons. So they will take active steps to make sure that you believe lies more readily than the truth. So when faced with a choice between the truth and a lie, most of us will believe the lie and not the truth. So lies are accepted quickly, whereas the truth is accepted slowly, if at all. And you see this with rumours and slander, accepted instantly without any checking. But if you tell the truth, if the truth is said, people doubt the truth and reject it, or they're slow to accept it, or they're very suspicious of it. But if an accusation is made that's a lie, it's much more appetizing, it's much more tasty. It's got a beautiful aroma. People find it really juicy and tasty, and they accept it immediately. Even the Bible speaks of this in Proverbs 26:22. It says, "The words of a whisperer are like delicious morsels that go down into the inner parts of the body." So people love lies. They love the taste of them. They love the smell of them. They love the sound of them in their ears. They like them. But partly as well because the demons are causing you to do that. So when the truth is told to you, the demons, who are, I think, involved in virtually all of our conversations and thought process, they're whispering in, they're whispering their input. When the truth is told to you, the demon is seeking to dissuade you from accepting it, giving you all sorts of reasons why you should doubt it or reject it. When a lie is told to you, the demon is, as in the judo analogy, pushing you with it. So when the lie is told, the demon is whispering into your ear to accept it, believe it, it's true. It's obvious. That's the way they operate. Now, when a lie is presented as a secret or something that's been leaked, it's even more readily accepted. People love secrets and leaks and things that are illegitimate and they have that beautiful aroma of illegitimacy about them that you've managed to get them by covert or inappropriate means. And it appeals to the flesh, makes it all the more enticing. And such things, therefore, are rarely scrutinized properly or at all. But when the truth is told, the demon whispers into your mind not to believe it, not to check it. You see? So when a lie is told, they're urging you to believe it and not to check it. But when the truth is told, they're telling you not to believe it. And that is why I think, if you look at when deciding whether a thing is true or false, I think most of us opt for the wrong answer far more than 50% of the time. Because unless you're taking diligent steps, a real effort to counteract all this, The toast is going to land butter side down much more than butter side up because of the involvement of the demons, the involvement of your flesh nature, and your inherent tendency towards believing lies. So, in the West, at least, demons don't tend to do spectacular things. Their preference is to be invisible, not noticed, not believed in. And as I mentioned about those people who were replying to me the other day, they think that someone who believes in demons is unhinged, possibly needing mental treatment, you know, at least thoroughly antiquated and, you know, ridiculously out of date. That's what they want us to think in the West. It suits them. Of course, elsewhere in the world, the demons are much more open. It suits them to be completely open about their existence. Here, it suits them to be covert about their existence and to deny even that they do exist. That's the way they do it. But we, at least, must recognize their existence. If you don't recognize their existence and their involvement, actively whispering into your ears all the time, you're going to make it much more difficult for you to identify where you're being misled. Because you're going to think that all those things, that the thoughts that are in your head, are all entirely your own thoughts. But if you realize that many of the thoughts you have in your own mind are not your thoughts, the demonic thoughts being whispered into your ear, not in the sense of you, not you think you this and you that. When the demon speaks into your mind, he speaks as you. He says, I. Because if he said you, you'd say, hang on a minute, who are you saying you? But if he says I, you think it's you speaking, you think it's yourself. So, I'm going to stop at that and we'll have a cup of tea. And we'll carry on with the next talk.